Dr. Sarna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
General Order Number 11 is one of the more compelling stories to come out of the U.S. Civil War, but comparatively few people know about it. How did you come across it?
Well, I think that for Jewish historians, it's something that's been known. And when I wrote the small section about the Civil War in my book, American Judaism, I was struck by the fact that the literature on the order was rather weak. And here was a moment when American Jewish history really came into contact with the larger history of the Civil War. It sounded like a story that deserved more attention. And I then had this opportunity to come back to the story. Of course, I had known the story much earlier, and I recount this in the beginning of the book. When I was a young scholar, I was invited to give a talk to the board of the institution where I was then teaching, and that was the anniversary of the order, the 120th anniversary, and new documents about the order had come into existence. And that was the first time I spoke about the order, and as I recount, it was quite memorable. I talked about the smuggling, and I then said we now knew that General Grant's own father had cooked up a scheme with the Mack brothers of Cincinnati to move Southern cotton northward. And no sooner was my speech over than a man raised his hand and began saying, "My name is Mack." And he, of course, turned out to be the great-grandson of the Mack who had been involved in that order. After a rather long and dramatic pause, I wondered what he was going to say. He said about the story, "And it's all true." And at that point, everybody relaxed. And of course, it was confirmation that the family had known the story, but had been embarrassed by it and kept it a secret. Later on, when I realized how little had been written and how in many ways the story of Grant and the Jews, which goes beyond the order, was a very inspiring story because Grant does a 180-degree turnaround. I thought it was worthy of a book, and this is the 150th anniversary of the order this December, so it made a great deal of sense to bring the book out now.
What is the substance of General Order Number 11?
General Order Number 11 reads that the Jews as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. Now, the department refers to the Department of the Tennessee, which is the area under Grant's command at the time. And it was a huge area, not just Tennessee. It stretched from northern Mississippi to Cairo, Illinois, and from the Mississippi River to the Tennessee River. So it was a big area and would include a city like Memphis, which had a fair a Jewish population at the time.
Could you paint us a picture of what life in the United States was like for the American Jewish community in the 1860s?
Well, the Jewish community had been growing very quickly at that time. There were perhaps 3,000 Jews in America in 1820, 15,000 in 1840, 150,000 in 1860. So most of the Jews were newcomers, immigrants from Central Europe. Many of them were merchants of one kind or another. And because opportunity lay west, a lot of these Jews had indeed moved across the country, and some of them had moved in to the south, opening up stores. The Jews' store, it would sometimes be called, opening up stores that really brought goods to places that often had not had those goods. They were performing an important economic function, but many of them were easily marked by their foreign accents and foreign ways.
Was the North or the South more hospitable to the Jews living there?
Well, that's a hard question. You certainly had many more Jews in the North than in the South. I think in the South, especially in places that had a white minority and a black majority, race was more important than religion. And as long as the Jews didn't rock the boat, they were white and they could gain acceptance. And there's no question that there were Jews who moved into very significant positions in the South, especially in the Confederacy. The Secretary of State of the Confederacy was Judah P. Benjamin, who also held a number of other significant positions. And we had other Jews in the Confederacy who held important positions. But I tend to think that they were able to achieve what they achieved there because of the color of their skin in many ways. In the North, I think Jews were still religiously other, although lots of people during the Civil War era were meeting Jews for the first time. It was true of many soldiers, and the country had to come to terms with a non-Christian religion. For example, in the North, the chaplaincy was initially confined to ministers of some Christian faith, and in time that was changed so they could also include rabbis. But I think this is a period where Jews are becoming more visible in American society.
I want to bring this around to the one of the first people we meet in the book. You begin the book with the story of one Jewish businessman in Paducah, Caesar Kaskel. Why did you put him front and center?
I'm very impressed with Caesar Kaskel. The story is that eventually General Order Number 11 gets to Paducah. The order travels very slowly for the simple reason that Grant's forces had been attacked and all of the telegraph wires had been cut. And there are about 30 families there, and they are ordered out. Now, Caesar Kaskel was a staunch Union supporter. His brother actually recruited for the Union. He was involved with the Union Club. But, the order didn't distinguish. It said Jews as a class. So he was ordered to leave. And he had the presence of mind not only to send a long telegram to Abraham Lincoln, but also to write up what we would call a press release and to distribute it to any reporter he met. And it was because of Kaskel that news of General Order Number 11 becomes known and gets into the newspapers. And then this man, like a kind of a Civil War era Paul Revere, gets down to Washington, spreading news of the order wherever he went. He goes to see a sympathetic congressman who gets him in to see Lincoln. Lincoln, of course, knew nothing about the order. It never had reached Washington because the telegraph lines had been cut. And years later, there is this wonderful conversation with Lincoln that is recorded. This may have been embellished, but it's still wonderful, where Lincoln says, "Oh, and so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan." And Kaskel cleverly replies, "Yes, and that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection." And Lincoln said, "Yes, and this protection they shall have at once." Lincoln indeed orders the General-in-Chief of the Army, Halleck, to countermand General Orders Number 11, and the order is indeed countermanded by Ulysses S. Grant. Kaskel is really the hero who spreads the news, goes to Washington, makes possible the revocation of the order.
Well, your book goes on to discuss General and later President Grant's efforts to make up for the order. The idea of atonement is a very central one in Judaism. The holiest day in the Jewish calendar is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Were Grant's subsequent actions his way of atoning for General Order Number 11, and did his relationship with American Jews improve because they saw that and responded to it?
Yes, I think they did. And you know, atonement has two parts to it. There's what you say, and there's what you do. So in 1868, Grant runs for president, and indeed this order becomes a quite central theme in the campaign, partly, I'm sure, to sway Jewish voters, but partly to spread doubt in the minds of all voters as to what kind of a person Grant was. And although Grant doesn't respond directly before the election, he does kind of indirectly. He doesn't want to be seen as pandering to any group of voters. After the election, he publishes a letter in which he writes, "I do not pretend to sustain that order. I have no prejudice against sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit." And that's really what Jews wanted to hear. And then, of course, the question was, well, what would Grant do when he was actually in the White House? And there is no question that as president, Grant lived up to that notion of judging individuals by their own merit. And he's the first president to have had a Jewish advisor. And he appoints a series of Jews to public office. And we know that he tried to appoint a Jewish cabinet member who turned him down. That was Joseph Seligman for Secretary of the Treasury. But he does appoint a Jewish governor of Washington. He appoints a Jew for the first time to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And even more significantly, from my perspective, he really supports Jews when they are persecuted abroad. Russia, for example, wants to expel Jews from a certain area known as Bessarabia for smuggling. And I'm sure there were aides to Grant who said, you know, don't touch this with a 10-foot pole. They'll remind you that you did the same thing, you know. And besides, we were on good terms with Russia. They just sold us Alaska at a good price. I'm sure he was under great pressure to do nothing. Nevertheless, Grant speaks out and says, you know, it is too late in this age of enlightenment to persecute anyone on account of race, color, or religion. And he calls for the revocation of the Russian order expelling the Jews. Subsequent to that, Jews are persecuted in Romania. Grant makes it possible for a Jewish consul to be sent to Romania, which was truly a symbol of what America thought. And Grant gives this consul, whose name was Benjamin Peixoto, a personal letter which says, "The United States, knowing no distinction of her own citizens on account of religion or nativity, naturally believe in a civilization the world over which will secure the same universal liberal views." This is a very early statement of the idea that America stands for human rights abroad, not only domestically. It's still, of course, an issue. Should we intervene in the internal affairs of other countries for reasons of human rights? And Grant felt that the answer was yes. We believe in a civilization that will secure universal liberal views, won't persecute any group. And Grant continues to demonstrate support for Jews, not only in the White House, but later, after he leaves the White House, when Jews are persecuted in 1881 in the Great Pogroms, as they were known in Russia. Grant is one of the first to sign a petition on their behalf. So he does a complete turnaround, and from the perspective of the Jewish community, when he dies, they view him as a hero to the Jewish community as much as he was a hero to the general community. They participate in his funeral. There is some discussion of General Order Number 11 and was he responsible or not responsible, but Jews certainly participate in the funeral and I think view him in the same heroic terms as other Americans. It's hard to remember, but in that period, the three greatest Americans in history were seen as George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant. Later in the 20th century, Grant's reputation, of course, takes a tumble, and the Jewish community forgets all of the history that I have tried to recover in when General Grant expelled the Jews. Now, I think, as Grant is being rediscovered by a new generation and his career is reexamined, and I think we have much more respect for what he tried to do during Reconstruction, it's interesting to look back at this chapter, seemingly a stain on his career, and to see that even here, in terms of the Jewish community, he repented and comes out looking very different than you would imagine if you read simply the Jewish Encyclopedia or the Encyclopedia Judaica, the new edition, which simply talks about his order expelling the Jews but doesn't recount any of the rest of the story.
What was General Grant thinking when he issued this order?
I think that Grant was deeply concerned about smuggling. He was a great believer in sieges, and he saw smuggling as truly undermining the Union cause. Now, we now know that all sorts of people were smuggling. There was a huge amount of money that could be made smuggling in both directions. But Grant blamed a widespread problem on a visible group. We often do that. Even now, it's the essence of prejudice, but we do it. The widespread problem was smuggling, but Jews were visible. They looked different. They sounded a little different with their accents. And he became persuaded that all smugglers were Jews, whether they were Jewish or not. But so that was the larger cause. The occasion, as I said at the beginning, was when he found that his own father, with whom he had a very complicated relationship, Jesse Grant, had cooked up a scheme with the Mack brothers, a Jewish firm in Cincinnati, to move Southern cotton northward. And he saw, wow, his own father is being entrapped, as he saw it, by the Jews. So we have a couple of accounts that he blew up and expelled the Jews. In many ways, he expelled the Jews instead of expelling his father on that occasion. So the occasion was very much a familial dispute. How could my father, my own father, have wanted to take advantage of my position and move Southern cotton north with all that would mean for giving currency to the South and prolonging the war, as he saw it? So, you know, they believed that you can't simultaneously fight an enemy and trade with that enemy.
Why isn't the wider community more familiar with this story?
It certainly is a good question. Hard to know why certain episodes are not better known. I think perhaps because so few Jews were actually expelled, that is to say, the word of the order spread slowly, and it was revoked before I couldn't find even 100 Jews who were expelled. So, you know, it becomes one of these events in a larger war. And after all, the war is filled with horrors. And I suppose some felt, well, in comparison with what happened and the thousands who gave their lives in some of these battles, this was a footnote. And the truth is that we know that there were other horrific episodes or denial of rights and so on in the Civil War. there were anti-Irish riots and obviously attacks on blacks and a good deal of anti-Catholicism, but we have generally not told the story of the war in that way. And of course, Grant himself makes no mention of this episode in his wonderful memoirs. They're very justly celebrated, but Grant thought that the less said about General Orders Number 11, the better. He does not mention it in his memoirs.
Further on, you talk about how this whole episode really ended up, instead of disempowering the American Jewish community, it empowered it.
Yes, I think the fact that Jews realized that they could get the order overturned, they could protest, this wasn't like other expulsions. You know, Jews could protest when they were expelled from Spain, but it didn't have any impact. But here in America, they could fight back and win. And then, indeed, in Grant's administration, Jews succeed in politics in a way that they never had been able to before. And I think that that emboldens the community and gives them a sense that they can indeed be equals in this country. And that's always important for any minority group.
Dr. Jonathan Sarna is professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University. His new book, When General Grant Expelled the Jews, is now out and available at bookstores and online. Dr. Sarna, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.